deck plate, bulkhead, and piece of machinery, with a shimmering onion-skin-thin layer of frost. It was like being inside a twinkling, multifaceted jewel. The only objects in the entire place that were clear of ice were the crates of HTX-20 themselves. Their warmth had prevented the frost from forming on them, but a quick scan had shown Kaylee that the explosives within had cooled considerably, almost back to the temperature they'd originally been at when they'd come aboard. It had worked, and that was all the more remarkable an achievement because it was an idea suggested by Jane Cobb. Kaylee had closed the cargo bay door, and Atmo had slowly begun hissing back into the ship's bowels. Now she wiped the sweat from her brow with the back of her hand, smearing a band of grease across it. She was worried sick about Mal and would start to sniffle quietly every time she thought about what he might be suffering, the more so when she allowed herself to entertain the notion that he might already be dead and lost to them forever. There was still no word from Book or Inara, still no update on Mal's likely whereabouts, and on top of that, Kaylee was afraid that the crew wouldn't be able to survive this dangerous mission without Mal's guidance. He had a way of seeing past trouble and finding a path to safety, even in the direst of situations. Zoe's voice crackled through the comm. Kaylee, we need you to recheck the cargo, make sure it stopped simmering. Kaylee cleaned her hands on a rag and tossed it in the general direction of the trash can. She didn't really want to go back near the explosives, but at least it was something to do. After Stuart Deacons left, Mal examined every inch of his cell, searching for a way to escape. If he could find a weakness in a wall or a soft spot in the floor, maybe he could burrow his way out with his heels. He found nothing, just solid, bare rock. Then he tested the mesh door, applying pressure first with his shoulder, then with his feet from a seated position, legs straight out in front of him. He could budge it some, but not nearly as much as he would have liked. Not enough to give him hope that he could force the door out of its frame with brute strength or even bend it slightly out of true so as to create a gap he might wriggle through. Accepting the futility of escape, he propped himself in the corner with his elbows bent, his fastened hands in the small of his back, his knees nestled against his chest. He dozed off a few times in this awkward position. He was exhausted, but kept snapping awake. Cramping in his shoulders wouldn't let him rest for long. He eased out the discomfort as best he could, but invariably it returned. Approaching footfalls echoed down the tunnel. They sounded purposeful. Mal hoped it was Deacons again. Perhaps something of what Mal had said to him had filtered through to the reservoir of good which he was sure still resided in the man. Perhaps Deacons' conscience had been fully awakened, and he was even now coming to set Mal free. No such luck. The new arrivals were David Zuburi, David's wife Sonia, and the hatchet-faced woman from before. Howdy, David, Mal said. Sonia? And you? He looked at Hatchet Face. Well, I know you and I have met, but we haven't been formally introduced. This ain't no social gathering, she retorted. But for your information, my name's Harriet Kyle. Miss or Mrs.? She kicked him in the ribs. Her boots must have had steel toe caps because it hurt unreasonably. In strained tones, Mal said, I'll take that as a check in the neither of the above box. Your trial's starting, David said. Up on your feet. Mal struggled upright. I thought we were waiting on some latecomers. We still are, Sonia said. They're en route and should be here soon, but Toby couldn't hang on any longer, nor could anyone else. The low tunnel ceiling seemed to press down on Mal's sore shoulders as he walked between his guards back to the cavern. There, a banjo was playing, and people were belting out the Independence battle hymn with all the zeal of a platoon of browncoats after a victory. Browncoats, look up to the skies. Browncoats, hail the dawn. Today we'll see tyranny dying with the morn. Browncoats, are you weary? Browncoats, rise and sing. Your time has come, your war is won. Victory takes wing. The battle hymn had heartened Mal on many a hopeless-seeming night. On this occasion, his spirits were not lifted. The song seemed more like an accusation than a rallying cry. David, Sonia, and Harriet escorted him through the crowd to the old disused drilling rig and shoved him up the stairs. On the platform beside it, Toby Finn stood with his arms outstretched, almost as though he was conducting the music. Mal kept his face impassive, wondering all the while just how short and one-sided this trial was going to be. "All right, browncoats, simmer down," Toby said, spying Mal and his escort. "The moment we've been waiting for is here." The group burst into cheers, raising their hands above their heads, high-fiving each other, applauding. Mal looked for Stuart Deakins. Their gazes met. Deakins looked away. Toby gestured for the browncoats to be quiet, and eventually they wore themselves out. Then Mal's former friend said, "I declare this trial open." A few stray hurrahs were quickly quashed. Aware that eyes were on him, Mal maintained his neutral expression, fixing it on like an iron mask. "Here's how this will work," Toby said. "I will call witnesses and present evidence against the accused. And the accused will defend himself." He slid a glance towards Mal, "since no one volunteered to defend you."
"What are the charges?" Mal asked.
"You are out of turn," Toby snapped. "You will speak when you are invited to. Do you understand?"
Mal said nothing.
"I said, do you understand?"
"Oh, hey, were you inviting me to speak?" said Mal. "I'm really not clear on the protocols. This is all new to me. Never had to defend myself in a trial before."
That drew a few chuckles, most of them derisive, but one or two amused. Toby narrowed his eyes and wagged a finger. Mal got the message. No playing to the gallery. Although, if that would save his life, he'd do it, of course. Toby cleared his throat. "Malcolm Reynolds, formerly of the 57th Overlanders, you come before this court facing four major charges. 1, high treason against the independent planets. 2, murder. 3, sabotage during wartime. And 4, collaboration with the enemy." He counted off the alleged crimes on his fingers. 3 of the charges carry with them the penalty of death. The charge of sabotage carries with it the sentence of life imprisonment without possibility of parole. He stared intently at Mal. "Do you understand these charges?" Since arriving in the mine, Mal had not been this physically close to Toby before, and as he held Toby's gaze, he realized that his former friend was not simply much thinner than he remembered. He was sick. His eyes were bloodshot and his skin was sallow. His cheeks tinted gray. His brown coat hung loose on him. During those years that they had lost touch, what had happened to the strong, fearless fighter Mal had known? Or for that matter, the puppy-eager youngster? Mal realized that this was not the time for flippancy. Not now. He needed to step up and tackle Toby head-on, meeting fire with fire, else he was doomed. Doomed as a rat in a nest of rattlesnakes. "I mean no disrespect, but I do not understand the charges at all," he said. "This ain't a true trial. Where's the jury of my peers? Where's the judge in robes? Don't see none of those. Just some jumped-up veteran spouting trumped-up charges in a room full of folks who ought to know better, lapping up his words like it's mother's milk."
"Listen to me, Tobias Finn, and listen good. We have history, you and I. We both know it. We both know we did things back on Shadow that neither of us is best proud of. I'm not referring to how we misbehaved and got up the noses of Sheriff Bundy, Deputy Crump, and all those other stick-up-their-ass types in Seven Pines Pass. I don't recollect any of that with anything but fondness. They were good times. It's Ginny Adair I'm referring to specifically."
Something sparked in Toby's eyes, briefly there, then gone.
"And if it's any consolation," Mal said, "I'm sorry. Truly I am. It was never my intention for anyone to get hurt, least of all you."
Grimness tightened Toby's face. "The charges have been read," he said.
"Toby, shut up. I know, Mal. I know. What do you know? That you're guilty. Guilty as sin. That's it? You know? That's all I need. It's all any of us here needs. Is it? 'Cause I look out over this gathering and I don't see the same certainty on all of the faces. He could tell that Stu Deacons was harboring doubts, if the way Deacons couldn't meet his eye was anything to go by, not to mention the benevolence he had shown back in the cell. And David Zuburi, who had earlier tried to restrain his wife from hurting Mal, was shuffling his feet. A couple of others seemed less firm in their resolve than the rest. It appeared that there were vigilantes here thinking for themselves, and that not everyone was 100% convinced of Mal's guilt. This could yet evolve into a real trial, despite the presence of a hanging judge. Maybe if we just, you know, hash this out, Mal went on, we might come to some resolution about how things happened from your point of view and from mine. I can't help but think there's been a massive misunderstanding. That is not how we are doing this, Toby shouted, overriding him. Just kill him now, shouted one of the onlookers. We know. You don't know anything, Mal shot back, or I would not be standing here falsely accused. I would have given my life to our cause, and there's people here who can be in no doubt about that. He found Deacons again and focused in on him. And I don't know what has happened in your life since to make you this hard-hearted and bitter, but I guarantee you killing me ain't gonna make you feel better. You shut the hell up, Sonia Zuburi shrieked at him. Do not try to confuse us, Malcolm Reynolds. We have searched the verse for you, and you will not escape justice. Justice has not shaken hands with any of us, Mal said. In a just verse, we would have won. You saw the Browncoats were going down at Serenity Valley, and you cut your losses and ran, Mal, Toby said, seizing the reins of the conversation, like a rat off a sinking ship. Huh? I never did anything of the kind. You did, Sonia shouted. I challenge you to prove even one iota of that statement to be true, Mal said, and Toby smiled a sickly, sinister smile. The smile of a fanatic so convinced of his own righteousness that no power in the verse would dissuade him from it. Oh, I shall. I shall. Toby waved a hand out at the crowd. And you will understand, my fellow Browncoats, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that we've got the right man, and we will be doing the right thing. The Planet Shadow, Long Ago.
Mal! Mal, they have Jamie!
Ginny Adair came galloping on horseback across the field where Mal was working, breaking up the rocky, hard-packed soil for planting. Mal cut the motor on the rotovator and mopped sweat from his brow with his sleeve.
Who has Jamie? He said.
Ginny reined in.
Bundy, Crump, they cornered him outside Camacho's Grain and Feed. Said they'd had a call about someone shoplifting. Jamie was coming out lugging a sack of cob nuts. He said to Bundy he'd paid for them fair and square, and if he was a shoplifter, he'd steal something way less bulky than a 40-pound bag of horse feed. Bundy and Crump took him away at gunpoint anyway.
Who told you this? Cat Camacho herself. She saw it all and called me straight away. Bundy's had a mad on for Jamie ever since we tried busting Willard Krieger out of jail.
Had a mad on for all of us, Mal said, recalling the number of times either Bundy or Crump or both of them had hassled him in the street, at the Silver Stirrup, lots of other places, while he was innocently going about his business. Several times Bundy had baldly stated his desire to run Mal and the other amigos out of town, or worse. He was itching for some payback after the humiliation of the jailbreak incident and Marla Finn's thwarting his attempted prosecution of the culprits. This campaign of harassment had been going on for months, and all of the four amigos had done their best to ride it out, hoping the sheriff and his sidekick would tire of it eventually. But now Bundy seemed to have ratcheted things up a gear.
They taken him to the jail? He said. I don't know. That'd be the first place to look, I guess.
Okay, let me get a horse and saddle up.
No time, you can ride with me.
Mal heaved himself up behind Ginny, and she spun her horse round and spurred it into motion. It was no hardship sitting with his arms around Jenny's trim waist, her back against his chest,
smelling her lavender-scented perfume at close range and a slight but heady tinge of sweat beneath it. Despite the circumstances, Mal wished the ride could have lasted longer. He'd had only sporadic contact with the Adairs since the jailbreak, and practically none at all with Toby. As far as he knew, Ginny and Toby were still an item, but in that moment, feeling this strong, beautiful woman in front of him, so capable, so determined, Mal's passion for her was rekindled. There was nothing he wanted more in the world, in the verse, than Ginny Adair. The town jail was locked up, empty. The sheriff's office was shut, too. Mal and Ginny made inquiries all over town, and eventually they learned that Bundy and Crump had driven out of Seven Pines Pass in their official police hover cruiser, headed towards Sageville on Arroyo Road. Mal and Ginny raced in pursuit. They had no idea what the police officer's plans were for Jamie, but they were sure Bundy and Crump intended no good. 4 miles out of town, they came across the hover cruiser parked by the roadside. 3 sets of footprints led away from the vehicle out into the wilderness. "We walk from here," Mal said, dismounting.
"Why? Riding'd be faster."
"Noisier, too. My hunch is it's better if they don't hear us coming. We can get the drop on them then." Ginny dismounted, too, and tethered her horse, then accompanied Mal as he began following the trail of footprints. Sheriff Bundy's heavier, deeper tread was discernible on the right of the three. The man could do with losing several pounds, and Mal could only assume the trudging set of footprints in the middle were Jamie's. The two police officers were manhandling Jamie along between them. This had all the hallmarks of a prisoner being walked towards the gallows. Suddenly, Mal gestured at Ginny to hunker down. He had heard voices up ahead. They crept forward on all fours through the sagebrush until they caught sight of Bundy and Crump standing beside a tall mesquite tree. Jamie was with them, and he had a noose around his neck. Ginny bit back a gasp of horror.
"They wouldn't,"
Mal hushed her.
"They won't," he whispered. "Not if I have anything to do with it."
As they watched, Bundy was jeering at Jamie, whose hands were cuffed behind his back.
"This has been a long time coming, kid. Ever since the Finn woman got you off the hook, you and your deadbeat pals have been asking for it. Now the chickens are coming home to roost."
"You're not going to do this, Sheriff," Jamie said.
It wasn't clear if he was making a prediction or a wish.
"You wouldn't dare. You're just trying to scare me."
"Am I?"
"Yeah, and just so's you know, it's working. I'm scared, okay? So, can we call it off now? You've accomplished what you set out to."
Crump tugged on the rope, cinching the noose that little bit tighter around Jamie's neck. The rope was slung over a bough of the mesquite, tied off around the tree's trunk.
"Have you got a gun?" Ginny asked Mal.
"Nope, only a knife. You?"
"No, didn't think to bring one. I was too panicked."
"It's probably for the best. Don't want to give Bundy and Crump cause to shoot us in self-defense. Not that they'd need much excuse by the looks of things."
"What are you going to do? Do you have a plan?"
"Definitely."
"Is it a good one?"
"Definitely not. Just stay low. When I give the signal, move."
"Move where?"
"I don't know. Just do something."
"Mal?"
"Yeah?" She kissed him. Just once, lightly, an inch to the side of his lips. It made him feel 10 feet tall. Mal rose from the sagebrush, waving his arms over his head.
"Oh, hi there, Sheriff. Deputy," he said at the top of his voice. "Fancy bumping into you guys out here in the middle of nowhere."
As one, Bundy and Crump turned and drew on him.
"Whoa," Mal said, striding out towards them.
"Easy, fellas. I'm not packing, as you can see. I'm here to parley. I see that we have what some would call a good old-fashioned lynching."
"What you see," said Bundy, not lowering his gun, "is the due process of the law. We caught Jamie Adair red-handed in the commission of an act of thievery. We are well within our rights to sentence and punish him in the manner of our choosing."
"Not sure I recall there being a trial."
"Not sure I care what you think, Reynolds. You could say my deputy and I are teaching you owl hoots a lesson. We're fed up to the back teeth with your games and your tomfoolery. I run an orderly town, and I won't stand for any sort of misbehavior."
"And you know what?"
Deputy Crump chimed in.
"When the Alliance comes and incorporates Shadow into the Union, and it's going to happen any day now, You'll find there'll be even stricter law enforcement. Those Alliance folk don't tolerate troublemakers. We've seen it on some of the Red Sun planets already. Alliance troops cracking down on anyone as gets too uppity. They call them insurgents, but we all know they're just crooks and criminals. And what do they call that cracking down? Said Bundy. They call it a police action. So we, as police ourselves, are only emulating their example. Starting with you, miscreants.
Mal shrugged.
I tell you, Sheriff, I'd already been given thought to joining up with the Independents. Seems as though you've just pushed me a few steps further in that direction. But let's not bring politics into this. Let's keep things strictly personal. How's about this? You take that there noose off of Jamie, then we all shake hands and walk away. No harm, no foul.
Or how's about I just plant a bullet in you right now? Said Bundy, on account of your committing an obstruction of justice. What do you say, Orville? Reckon that'd fly?
Reckon it'd fly right nicely, said Crump. Better still, you can halt there, Reynolds, exactly where you are. Don't come a step nearer.
Mal did as bidden, in the full knowledge that either Bundy or Crump would drill a hole in him if he disobeyed. He was now within 10 paces of the mesquite tree, and somewhat closer to Crump than to Bundy.
Good boy, said Bundy. Stay put, and you can watch your pal Jamie dangle, knowing there ain't a thing you can do about it. Knowing, too, that it'll be your turn next.
Jamie cast Mal a frantic look. Both of them had come to the same realization. Bundy and Crump were not kidding around. This was not all just some piece of theater. They were going to go through with the hanging. Because they could. Because they were the law. Because the prospect of war in the verse, which over the past few weeks had become less of a possibility and more of a cast-iron certainty, seemed to have given them the courage to act as intemperately and self-indulgently as they liked. Because when chaos loomed, reason and accountability went out of the window. Behind his back, Mal flapped his hand at Jenny. He trusted she would interpret the gesture correctly. He was telling her to get out of there. Nothing was to be gained by her remaining. He and Jamie were as good as dead. No point her making it 3 for 3. In the event, the vagueness of his plan, the non-existence of it really, worked against him. Jenny, instead of fleeing, stood up out of the sagebrush.
Well, well, well,
said Bundy, pushing his wide-brimmed hat back on his head with the barrel of his pistol.
Looky here. Got the whole gang just about, apart from the Finn brat. Now we got us a proper audience. Ain't no one gonna be more upset about Jamie Adair's neck getting stretched than his kid sister.
Please, Sheriff Bundy, I'm begging you, Jenny said. Let him go.
You got something you wanna bargain with, girl?
Bundy's leer made it patently obvious what he was hinting at.
'Cause tempting though that'd be, I think I'd much rather watch you watch your brother die. Talk about satisfying. Orville, I'll keep my gun trained on these two. You set about doing what needs to be done.
Deputy Crump holstered his sidearm and unlashed the rope from the tree trunk. Then he took the strain and started to pull, using the trunk like a pulley to mitigate the weight on the other end of the rope. Jamie's feet left the ground. His legs kicked. The noose tightened and he began making horrendous choking, gargling noises. His face rapidly purpled. Mal knew he had one shot at this. He might die as a consequence. He might die even before he was able to achieve what he was setting out to do. But either of those fates was better than allowing Bundy and Crump to get away unopposed with what was unarguably cold-blooded murder. He whisked his knife from its sheath and slung it through the air. The blade cleaved clean through the rope inches above Jamie's head. Sheriff Bundy's attention had been divided between Mal and Jenny. Hence, he was slow getting off a shot at Mal. So slow that Mal had time to duck out of the way, even as Jamie tumbled to the ground. Deputy Crump also fell as the rope was cut and went slack in his hands. Suddenly, with nothing to counterbalance him, his strenuous pulling was converted into strenuous falling backwards. He sprawled in the dust. Mal pounced, planting a knee on Crump's chest to pin him down, then slid the deputy's gun out of its holster. He drew a bead on Bundy, cocking the hammer. Standoff. Ginny ran to Jamie's side and released the noose. Jamie rolled over, retching and wheezing. Bundy eyed Mal beadily.
You won't, boy. You don't have the stones. You ain't never shot no one in your life, and the last person you're gonna start with is a lawman.
Or maybe, said Mal, the first. And he fired. Neither Ginny nor Jamie could believe it. Same went for Crump, who stared up at Mal aghast. Even Mal himself was a little surprised. It was as though some part of him had known he had no choice, while another part reeled in astonishment. Bundy went down like a sack of coal. For several long moments, Mal was convinced the sheriff was dead. He hadn't known he had it in him to kill someone. Now he understood what it took. The right motivation, the right mix of necessity and desire. This was it. He had crossed a bridge he could not cross back. His life from now on would never be the same. Then Bundy hauled himself up into a sitting position.
Gorram, ow, he cried, clutching his shoulder. That hurts like a tama de hundan.
Not dead, just wounded. Mal didn't know how he felt about that. Relieved, yes, but not entirely.
You moron, Reynolds, Crump exclaimed, still pinned under Mal's knee. We weren't really going to hang him.
Huh? You expect me to believe you?
Believe what you want, it's true.
Sure is, said Bundy. You think we'd be able to get away with something like that? Especially not with that fancy-talking lawyer bitch Finn woman around. Nope, all's we were doing is giving a dare a scare. I've heard tell it can take a man up to 6 minutes to pass out during a short drop hanging, 20 minutes till he's actually dead. We weren't gonna let him dangle more than a minute or so.
Making a point, said Crump, teaching him a lesson, teaching all of you lot.
Some goram lesson, Jamie croaked.
Sure looked to me like you were gonna go through with it, Mal said.
And to me, said Ginny.
Wouldn't have been effective if it hadn't been convincing, said Bundy.
And that stuff about hanging me as well, said Mal. That just big talk too?
Damn straight, said Bundy.
Mal rose to his feet. Okay, he said. Fact remains, you crossed a line, both of you.
As did you, Reynolds, said Crump, shooting an officer of the law.
Mal turned the gun on him. I can always make it two officers of the law, want that? Crump gulped and shook his head.
Then shut up and listen. I reckon we all need to come to some sort of accommodation here. This is my proposal. Events went as follows. You, Sheriff Bundy, and you, Deputy Crump, came out into the wilds in order to carry out some target practice. There was an accident. Crump discharged his gun, this very one in my hand, and wounded his superior officer. That's it. No attempted hanging, bogus hanging, whatever it was. Jamie, Ginny, and I weren't even here. What do you say? Sound reasonable?
Bundy's expression was steely. Blood oozed out over the fingers of the hand he was pressing against the bullet hole. Finally, he said,
Seems as though I don't have a choice.
You do. You can choose not to go along with what I'm suggesting, and both you and your buddy Orville will find yourselves in shallow graves in the shade of this very tree. You think I'm not serious? I wasn't aiming to wound you just now, Bundy. I was aiming to kill. And now that I've started down that road, don't see as how I'm liable to stop. There won't be any witnesses to your deaths, at least none that'll testify against me. Ain't that right, Ginny? Jamie?
Sister and brother both nodded resolutely.
There we go, said Mal.
But just to make sure the three of us walk away unharmed and you don't get it into your heads to shoot us in the back, we're going to empty your gun of its shells, Sheriff, and this one as well, and take your ammo belts.
When that was done and Mal had unlocked the handcuffs on Jamie using the key from Crump's belt, he and the Adair siblings took their leave of the lawmen, heading back to the road. While Ginny got back on her horse, Mal hotwired the police cruiser and drove it off with Jamie in the passenger seat. There seemed nothing to be gained by making it easy for Bundy and Crump to get back to town.
Mal, Jamie said, how can I ever thank you?
You don't need to. You'd have done the same for me.
I would have, at that.
He fingered the line of rope burn on his neck.
I knew Bundy'd been getting more and more out of control lately.
Just never realized he might take it as far as he did. Think he's gone a little crazy. Think the whole verse is going a little crazy. Bundy's craziness just a byproduct of that. Yeah, I wouldn't have put it past him to kill me, though. Wasn't any doubt in my mind but that I was a goner. And now you've interfered, he's only going to hate us all the more. That was some fancy knife throwing, by the way. I was aiming for Crump, Mal said.
Really?
Yeah, and I'd have got him too if that damn rope hadn't gotten in the way. They both laughed.
Listen, were you being serious back there, Jamie said, about signing up with the Independents?
I'm giving it some proper thought. Crump wasn't wrong about how the Alliance is behaving on the Red Sun Worlds and elsewhere. As you can see from what I did to him, I would seem to have a problem with authority riding roughshod over people. Guess that sentiment extends way beyond Seven Pines Pass, Shadow, the Georgia system, all the way out into the wider verse. Besides, ain't as if there's much going on for me here. Just farm work, ranching, the day-to-day grind.
The call of adventure, huh?
Something like that. Got me a feeling that I'm hearing it too, Jamie said. Maybe it takes a brush with death to put things into perspective. If you threw in with the Independents, I might just too. There's a recruiting office open up in Da Changshi, I heard.
I heard that too.
Not sure how I'd break it to my parents. Same with me and my mother. Might be best if we just didn't. Simply hop the train to Da Changshi without telling them. You think Ginny would join us? I'm not sure how she feels about the whole situation. She doesn't much like the Alliance, that's for sure, but I reckon it'd be better if she stays at home anyway, for our parents' sake. One child running off, like as to get himself killed, is bad enough. But both of them?
Yeah, I see your point.
But Mal might quite have liked it, were Ginny to have come along with them to Da Changshi. Might have quite liked to spend some time in close proximity to her, without Toby around. See what developed.
You don't think we'd be running away, do you? Jamie said.
What do you mean?
From Bundy. Because if I know that man, he's going to be sticking to our agreement for a while, but when his shoulder's better, when he's back on his feet, he'll be fuming. He won't let it rest. He'll come after us again.
You think?
I think he's licked and he knows it.
Maybe you're right. You've always been the confident one, Mal.
Or, Mal thought, the one who doesn't think things through or care about the repercussions.
They abandoned the police cruiser on the outskirts of Seven Pines Pass and walked the rest of the way in. Jamie announced that the drinks were on him and they headed straight for the Silver Stirrup, where Ginny caught up with them later. It turned into one of the epic drinking sessions of Mal's life. 5 straight hours of necking beers and whiskey chasers and laughing uproariously with the Adair siblings. And when it was over, Jamie staggered homeward in the dark, while Ginny accompanied Mal to the Reynolds Ranch, leading her horse because she was far too inebriated to ride.
What happened next was as inevitable as it was, in hindsight, regrettable. They got as far as the bluff overlooking town. Next thing they knew, they were kissing. Next thing they knew after that, Ginny had laid out her horse's saddle blanket on the ground. Beneath the stars on a hot night, with all 3 of Shadow's moons on the rise and a slight cooling breeze, they made love. It was sweet and fierce, tender and spectacular, unforgettable. Afterwards, as they lay together with Ginny's head cradled in Mal's arm, she said,
"We shouldn't have done that."
"What, taking the Lord's name in vain as much as we just did?"
"No, I mean it."
Her face was serious.
"Toby and I, we're still together. As far as he's concerned, we're a couple. I think he's going to ask me to marry him. He keeps mentioning engagement rings and stuff and looking at houses for sale."
"That does surely seem like the talk of someone with marriage on their mind. What do you think about it?"
"I think I love Toby, but I don't love him, if you see the difference."
"The difference being 2 loves instead of 1?
Can you ever not be facetious?
If I knew the meaning of the word, I'd know what I wasn't supposed to be. So if Toby proposes, I'll say no, and crush him forever."
"Don't say that," Ginny snapped. "Please, don't. You know it's true. A guy like Toby, when he gets wrapped up in a girl, there ain't nothing gonna untangle him easily. Not without it hurting him plenty, especially a girl like you. But I can't say yes if he isn't the man I want to be with for the rest of my life."
Mal wondered if he might be the man Ginny would want to be with for the rest of her life. He didn't dare voice the thought for fear that he would be as crushed as Toby was going to be when Ginny rejected his proposal.
"Whatever happens," Ginny said firmly, "this thing tonight, you and me, it was a one-off. You hear me, Mal? It was terrific. It was lovely. But it's not going to be repeated."
"So what? This was just my reward for saving your brother?"
"No, no. I need to figure out where I stand with Toby, apart from anything else."
Mal was crestfallen. He was also quite sure within himself that despite what she said, it was not going to be a one-off. And he was right. He and Ginny kept contriving to be in the same place at the same time, their paths crossing seemingly by accident, but not really. These random encounters all had the same outcome. And there would be guilt afterwards and a vow not to see each other again, invariably broken. Naturally, Toby was appalled when he learned about what Bundy had done or tried to do, and said he would inform his mother. She would have Bundy out of a job within a week and sue him for damages, too. Mal and Jamie, however, persuaded him not to tell her. They reckoned Bundy was neutralized, Crump as well. Both lawmen were so far sticking to the story Mal had concocted about a firearms accident. Both were getting ribbed for it by the locals and were taking the mockery stoically. Their feigned chagrin suggested to Mal that they wanted to put the truth of the incident behind them, and involving Marla Finn might just stir up something that appeared settled. If Bundy were plotting any kind of revenge, he was hiding it well. Maybe, for all of his pig-headedness, even he realized he had overstepped the mark and needed to pull back. Then war broke out on Shadow. The Alliance had been pushing its influence further and further out from the core, sweeping up more and more planets in its barbed wire embrace. All across the verse, there had been skirmishes between Alliance troops and opposition forces, ragtag militias that were poorly armed but made up for it with guts and determination. It was war in all but name, until finally the Alliance declared that a state of hostility existed between it and all worlds that resisted its influence. This was simply formalizing what had hitherto been implicit. By then, Ginny had broken it off with Toby. She had also broken it off with Mal. Toby did not know that they had been seeing each other behind his back, but Ginny felt she could not simply take up with Mal, not so soon after ending things with Toby. She said she needed time out to think about their relationship and figure out what she herself wanted, promising it was just temporary. She was still bruised and fragile from having to jilt Toby. It had not been an easy decision. Toby came to Mal for consolation, and one of the hardest feats Mal had ever pulled off was offering the kid a shoulder to cry on. He ached to tell Toby about himself and Ginny, but knew he never could. He couldn't shake off the feeling that he had lost her. Instead, he comforted Toby, got him drunk, was every inch the good friend. Next day, he found himself on that train to Da Cheng Shi. Jamie was with him. So was Toby. Once again, as before during the heyday of the Four Amigos, Toby was tagging along. His motives were straightforward. He couldn't bear to remain in Seven Pines Pass. He couldn't stay as long as Ginny was there, a constant reminder of what he had once had and could never have again. He hated the Alliance, that was for sure. He detested what they were doing. He wanted to stand up and be counted, to give those bullies a bloody nose, to draw a line in the sand. But whereas for Mal and Jamie that was reason enough to do what they were doing, Toby was driven by a still darker imperative: misery. Once more, Toby addressed the crowd of browncoats in the mining cavern.
"Here is how it went down," he said. "Less than a year after Mal and I enlisted, along with our friend Jamie Adair, the Alliance bombed the hell out of our home planet, Shadow. By then, we'd all been through basic training. You all know how that was. Sometimes brutal, sometimes boring, sometimes downright amateurish. But we were all pulling together, all on the same side. It felt good even when we were slogging along knee-deep in mud, trying to keep formation,
pretending to fire these broom handles they'd given us instead of guns because they didn't have any real guns to spare, aiming them at an enemy that wasn't there. Yet. Then came a lull. Our drill sergeants, some of whom seemed to be just making it up as they went, told us to go home. They taught us all they could. They would summon us when we were needed. The war was drawing closer to shadow every day, like this big thundercloud on the horizon steadily growing bigger and bigger, more and more ominous. We were told to go be with our loved ones for a spell and wait for the call. It'd be coming soon enough. Mal, Jamie, and I returned to Seven Pines Pass, our hometown. Jamie's sister Jenny was waiting to meet us off the train, and she wasn't happy with any of us. No, sir, on account of we'd up and left her behind without telling her where we were going, and she'd had to find out about it the hard way, through a wave from Jamie. Each of us had our reasons for keeping her in the dark, the details of which needn't detain us here. However, Jenny and a few of the locals were keen to do their bit, and so they'd begun stockpiling arms, against the likelihood of the Alliance occupying Shadow. They'd put together a sizable cache, enough to equip a platoon, or maybe more, and had stashed it out back of a meadow on the Adair property in a cowshed. Mal remembered that cowshed for various reasons. One was that he and Jenny had met there for a tryst on several occasions. The smell of mingled cow musk and hay never failed to evoke strong feelings in him, even to this day. Sometimes it was almost, in a bizarre way, an aphrodisiac. Other times it could reduce him to tears. He also remembered the cowshed for the smoking ruin it had become, all twisted spars of charred wood sticking upwards with a halo of scorched earth around it, and for the burned, mutilated corpse lying close by. Jenny's and Jamie's parents knew what was being kept there, Toby continued, but turned a blind eye. Jenny took it upon herself to guard the arms cache round the clock. It was her way of showing support for the independent cause. And here's the kicker. She was guarding it that night when the Alliance called in a Zeus missile strike to destroy it. She was there when a space-to-ground projectile fitted with 1,000 pounds of explosive sailed in from heaven and obliterated that cowshed and everything in it and everything within 100-yard radius around it, including Jenny. Faces stared up at the platform, and Mal stared at nothing. All he saw was Jenny's dead body, burned into a contorted skeletal parody of its living version. The face, like a blackened skull, jaws opened in a soundless scream. The cindered remains that were barely recognizable as those of the first woman he'd ever truly loved. All these years, Mal had assumed that rage had burned away the last of his deep grief, but now his heart sank down into another icy pit, brimming with sorrow so thick he began to drown. Couldn't breathe, couldn't think. The crowd had fallen silent, as if in respect for the dead. Exhausted, out of gas, Mal hung his head and mourned everything that had happened between Jenny and him, and everything that had not happened. After a long moment, Toby stretched out a hand and pointed at Mal. When they told him that she'd died, the first words out of the mouth of Malcolm Reynolds were, "She was supposed to be safe." Mal recalled the moment. Those were his exact words, spoken to Jamie and Toby. Someone, he forgot who, came running into the silver stirrup to announce the missile strike. They'd all heard the detonation not 10 minutes earlier and seen the accompanying far-off flash in the sky. And they all had speculated what it signified, whether it was simply the onset of a thunderstorm or something more sinister. The moment they learned it was a missile aimed at the Adair ranch, they sprinted out that way. The farmhouse itself was intact, save for the fact that every single window pane in it had been blown out, and the roof was missing several shingles. Mr. and Mrs. Adair were likewise shaken but unhurt. However, no sooner did Mal see the impact site and Jenny's body than he fell to his knees and uttered the sentence Toby had just quoted. What he didn't grasp was why it mattered. what significance she was supposed to be safe carried for Toby. That was when Toby slid a hand into his pocket and retrieved a small, rounded lump of metal that had been distorted out of its original shape by intensely high temperatures. It was roughly the size and shape of a fob watch, and for a moment Mal could not fathom what it was or why Toby had produced it. Then it dawned on him. It was the locket. The gold locket with the ornate J, the one he hadn't given to Ginny, and then later, much later, had. Toby levered open the lid with some difficulty. The hinge barely worked. Inside was a mass of circuitry fused into so much silvery goo. "See that, everyone?" He displayed the locket to the crowd. "See that, Mal? A homing beacon. The homing beacon that you put there. The homing beacon which gave the Alliance the exact coordinates for the arms cache. Thanks to you, they couldn't miss. Thanks to you, Ginny Adair died." 31.
"Hades," said Zoe, leaning over the comms panel on Serenity's bridge. "You sure that's right, Book?"
"That's what Elmira says," Book replied. His voice crackled, distance distorting the signal.
"As in the lesser of Persephone's two moons?" said Wash. "Sibling to the larger, brighter Rinnow, and usually part eclipsed by it."
"Sure," said Zoe. "But what in hell are they doing on Hades? There's nothing there."
"I think that's kind of the point," said Book. "If you take someone prisoner and have malicious designs on them, the best place to spirit them off to is somewhere remote and undesirable, somewhere no one goes.
And the intel sound?
Elmira has nothing to gain by lying. Put it this way, Hunter Covington enslaved her, abused her, threatened to kill her. It isn't in her interests to cover for him. In fact, her exact words were, 'If your friends catch up with him and manage to put a bullet in him, I'm not going to shed a single tear.'"
"Well, you can tell her from me," Zoe said. "If I see him, I'll do just that. Him and anyone else involved in Mal's kidnapping."
"I'm already plotting a course towards Hades, Shepard," Wash said, stabbing buttons on the control console. "Just one question. Where precisely on Hades? Any idea? Because it's not the biggest rock in the verse, but it's not the smallest either, and if we don't have any clear idea where to put down, we could be searching a long time."
"I asked Elmira that myself. She doesn't know, but you'll find the location, Wash. I'm sure of it. If I do, it'll be some kind of miracle."
"Miracles happen," said Book.
"Not in my experience," Wash muttered as Zoe cut the connection. He hit the ship's intercom.
"Kaylee?"
"Yeah?
How are the engines doing?"
"Shiny-ish."
"Good enough, 'cause I'm about to go for maximum burn. We think we know where Mal is."
"Oh my God, for real?"
"Yep, you just make sure Serenity keeps spaceborne."
"On it."
"Buckle up, honey," Wash said to Zoe. "I'm going to give you the ride of a lifetime."
"Promises, promises," Zoe said, strapping herself into a seat.
Wash thrust the yoke forward, and Serenity's tail end lit up like a Chinese lantern, coruscatingly bright. The ship diverted sleekly round onto her new course, Wash pouring on speed, extracting every ounce of thrust her engines could provide.
"Shouldn't take us more than an hour," he said to his wife, "assuming nothing breaks or blows up."
Zoe laid a hand on his arm.
"Just shut up and fly, Wash. This is what you do, so do it."
32. The Planet Shadow, Long Ago. A week before Ginny died, Mal came over to her house and gave her the locket.
"What's this?" she said, staring at the trinket.
"A love token?"
"Yes, I mean, no. No, nothing like that. I saw it in a shop in Dachengxi."
He didn't say when he'd seen it.
"Saw the J on it and thought of you."
"Well, that's mighty nice of you." "Weren't it just? I want you to have it. Not to remember me by or any of that stuff. That's not what this is about at all. Look inside. I've added a little something."
Ginny pressed the tiny catch which opened the locket. Inside lay a gleaming knot of technology.
It's a hearing aid? She said, frowning at him, half smiling.
A homing beacon, Mal said.
And why do I need a homing beacon?
Because when the war hits Shadow, who knows where I'm going to end up? I may not even be planetside, and you may get called away too. I don't believe for one moment that you're going to stay put and tend to this arms cache of yours indefinitely. Those weapons will be gone soon enough, and the Jinny Adair I know isn't going to be content living at the old homestead, splitting logs and shoveling cow dung.
You got that right.
No, she's going to become a... what are they calling us? A brown coat.
Ain't such a pretty name, is it? Jinny said.
No, and that reminds me. I need to buy myself a brown suede coat, otherwise I'm not going to fit in. But to my point, when you're a brown coat and I'm a brown coat, we could be light years apart, at opposite ends of the verse. But that there homing beacon is linked to a matching homing beacon which I have in my safekeeping, and if ever we want to find each other or simply know where each other is, those two little doohickeys will be able to tell us. They're powered by thermoelectric energy, using the differential between body heat and the ambient temperature to keep them charged. As long as we're wearing them, they'll have juice. And if one of them stops working, well, then the next time the other person activates their beacon, they'll know the worst has happened.
Oh, well.
He couldn't tell if she was touched or perplexed. Then he saw tears falling from her eyes, splashing onto the locket. He took the trinket from her hands and draped it around her neck.
Just wear it, he said. For me. Doesn't mean we're engaged to be wed or anything. Ain't that at all.
No way, definitely nothing of the sort. But know that I will always have my own beacon with me at all times, whether or not you have yours. If I want to check if you're safe, or you me, this is how.
They kissed, and it was long, lingering, and over too soon. Then Jinny turned away from him and walked off, her head a little bowed, her step a little faltering, as though it was taking everything she had not to turn around and run back to his arms.
May I speak? Mal said. I think it's my turn now. I'm owed the right of response.
Hear, hear, said someone in the crowd.
Mal wasn't sure, but it sounded a lot like Stuart Deacon's.
Very well, said Toby with a great show of magnanimousness.
That homing beacon wasn't anything to do with the Alliance, Mal said. Don't even know how you could think it might have been.
I had a tech expert look over it. No question, it was designed to send out a location signal. You knew Jinny was guarding the arms cache 24/7. You gave her the beacon to lead the Alliance right to it. You might as well have painted crosshairs on her back.
And why in hell would I do that, Toby? What would I get out of it? Jinny was my friend, my good friend. You saw me after we found the body. You saw how I was a goram mess. For about a week after, I could barely speak, came close to blowing my own brains out several times. That's how bad her death screwed me up.
Oh, it was a fine display of grief you put on, that's for sure, Toby said. The rest of us were feeling it genuinely and showed it in our different ways. But no one could rival Mal Reynolds when it came to the histrionics. I ain't that good an actor. I'm not saying you were acting, Mal. I'm saying you just went over the top with it. You were torn up about Jinny, no question. But maybe you were so torn up because you knew you were the one responsible.
Well, how am I supposed to argue against that kind of logic? Mal said, exasperated. Can't win either way. If I hadn't been upset, you'd be accusing me of not caring because I was her killer. Since I was upset, you're saying it's because I had a guilty conscience. Anyways, it was Sheriff Bundy who told the Alliance about the arms cache. Everybody thought so.
It was a rumor, said Toby. A rumor you yourself, Mal, did a great deal to spread about.
Bundy hated us. You, me, Jamie, and Jinny. We'd pissed him off dozens of times, and I'd maybe pushed it too far by wounding him with a bullet that time he tried to hang Jamie. Not that he didn't have it coming. He was looking at ways to hit back at us, and he knew what had hurt me, you, and Jamie more than anything would be killing Jinny. She was the glue that held the four of us together. If he wanted to destroy us, her death'd do it. But he wasn't going to carry out the deed himself. Man was too cunning for that. If he could get the Alliance to do his dirty work for him, though,
then his hands would be clean, plus he'd be ingratiating himself with Shadow's soon-to-be overlords. And it worked, didn't it? Soon as Alliance troops stepped foot on Shadow, some of them came down Seven Pines Passway, and next thing, the county governor had been executed on some spurious pretext, and Sheriff Bundy was appointed in his stead. It was almost like his fee for services rendered.
Circumstantial. A theory, Toby said. You didn't have any proof that that was what happened. All it was what you wanted everyone to believe was the case. If it was true, why didn't you go after Bundy?
Believe me, I was tempted. If I'd had hard evidence he was to blame instead of just a strong suspicion, I'd have blown the bastard clean out of his socks. Before I could go about accumulating that evidence, however, High Command gave us our marching orders, and you know what? I was right glad to get the hell off of Shadow. Staying there a moment longer might have killed me. I've got a question for you, Toby Finn. How come you have that beacon at all? Wasn't it buried with Ginny?
I found it when I helped ferry her to the town morgue, Toby replied. You weren't much use in that regard. You were too busy wailing and tearing your hair out and drenching yourself in misery so's everyone could see. Me and Jamie, we got on with the business of making sure Ginny got a decent burial. Once the ground around the cow's shed had cooled enough for us to pick up the body, that's what we did. And while we were moving her, I spied that locket and I got curious about it. It wasn't something I'd given her, her parents neither. I asked them later and even they didn't know how she'd come by it. So I took it off her body when no one was looking, opened it up when I got home, saw what was inside. I didn't know she'd got it from you, not then. All's I knew was that someone had planted a beacon on Ginny without her knowing and had used her as a living target. And I vowed that when I found out who it was, nothing would stop me from exacting vengeance upon that individual. And at last, the day has come. A day I've been waiting for, looking forward to, dreaming of for more years than I care to think.
And how can you be so sure it was me that did it? Mal said. I didn't have evidence pointing the finger at Sheriff Bundy, and you don't have none pointing it at me.
Are you so sure, Mal? Toby sneered. I think you'll find I have plenty of evidence.
But that beacon isn't what you think it was. Like I said, it wasn't anything to do with the Alliance. It was... Before Mal could finish the sentence, there was a sudden ripple of activity amongst the assembled browncoats. Heads were turning. People were murmuring to one another. Somebody had just entered the cavern. Not just anyone either, but Hunter Covington, complete with Cobra Head Kane. Accompanying him was a person Mal also recognized, the man from Taggart's, the guy in the mustard yellow duster who'd sent him outside to get bushwhacked by Covington and his goons.
A very good evening to you all, said Covington. Actually, that should be morning. Day's dawning out there, in case you hadn't realized. Sky was brightening just as we came into land. Looking like a peach of a day, and there is Mr. Malcolm Reynolds all trussed up and set to swing. Seems we arrived just in time, wouldn't you say, Harlow?
Yellow Duster, Harlow, nodded in agreement.
You are indeed just in time, gentlemen, Toby said. Just in time to watch one of the vilest men in brown coat history get his comeuppance.
33. Serenity swung into orbit around Hades. It was a smooth ball of rock a couple of 100,000 miles from Persephone, rolling in a slow, lazy ellipse around its mother planet. There were a few mountain ranges, a few craters, but apart from those, it was featureless. Terraforming had been attempted, but all Hades had to show for it was atmosphere. Vegetation had failed. There had been no release of water from its frozen poles. Colonization had therefore been impossible, and the moon had been abandoned as a failed project, left to carry on along its way more or less unmolested. Since then, prospectors had sniffed around, digging down in the search for valuable minerals such as iridium, palladium, manganese, and molybdenum, not to mention platinum and gold. Yet again, however, Hades had proved disappointing, yielding nothing more valuable than iolite and ametrine, semi-precious gemstones whose retail price was not high enough to justify the cost of their extraction.
Nothing, Zoe said, surveying the moon's surface on the scanning screen. Nothing but wasteland.
There was a note of despair in her voice.
If there was maybe a building of some sort, Wash said, some sign of civilization, then we might have something to aim at. But there ain't. It's just a ghost world.
Can you run a sweep? Already doing that. Thermal scan in a grid pattern with the gain turned way up high. If there's any kind of heat signature beyond natural background, it'll register. So far, nada.
Jane entered the bridge, ducking under the lintel of the low doorway.
That it, huh? He said, looking out at Hades through the viewing port array. Not much to write home about.
If you don't have anything useful to contribute, Zoe said.
Just saying. Seen more life in a 3 days dead dog. Mal somewhere down there?
Supposedly.
And we got no chance of finding him. Not unless we had a week to look, and I don't reckon we got nearly that long. Vigilantes'll probably have plugged him already.
Really, Jane, if you don't shut up.
Hey, Zoe, don't blame me if I'm the realist around here. Somebody has to be.
Here's an idea. Let's just assume we are going to find Mal. We ought to make preparations. So why don't you go to your bunk, fetch out Vera, give her a good clean, and then she'll be all ready for if she's ever needed.
Jane nodded.
That ain't a half bad idea.
He retreated out of the bridge.
Wash said, Did you really just tell Jane to go to his bunk and polish his rifle?
Uh-huh.
You know he'll never realize that was a thinly veiled insult, right?
Uh-huh.
My God, woman, I so want to ravish you right now. Focus on the matter at hand, Wash.
Too late. My mind has already gone down the dirty path.
I'm thinking when this is over, you and me, we... Oh, wait. We just want she knew second.
Something had flared on the thermal scan screen. Amidst the neutral grays and blues of Hades' surface, there was a tiny blob of glowing orange. Wash tapped instructions into a keyboard to enhance the image and zero in.
Oh yeah, attaboy.
What is it? Zoe asked.
Looks like the exhaust profile of a private yacht. Just landed. Engine cycling down and the thrusters are cooling, but still radiating residual heat.
Enough to get a fix on?
Done. Coordinates logged in.
Whose craft?
My guess is Covington's. According to Elmira, Covington headed out to join the vigilantes in a yacht, didn't he? That's him down there, parked wherever they are.
Book said miracles happen, Zoe murmured.
And so does amazing piloting, said Wash. I'm calculating reentry. Every moment counts. No time for slick and smooth. We're going in fast and we're going in hard.
Zoe smirked. Is your mind still on the dirty path?
Wash grinned.
A little bit, he said, and yanked on the yoke.
34.
Why are you even here?
Mal called across the cavern to Hunter Covington.
Don't reckon as you were ever a brown coat?
How can you tell?
Covington replied.
On account of brown coats have integrity, and you don't.
For what it's worth, I did my best to stay neutral during the war.
Yeah, like most gutless profiteering streaks of Zheng Mao Niao did.
I was open to opportunities wherever they arose, Covington said. Still am. To nail your colors to a single mast is so...